This is Kevin Altieri, director of Batman the Animated Series.
This is best friend of the show, Monica Cabina, artist and colorist on Batman The Adventures Continue.
And this is the DCAU Review.
Hosted by Cal and Liam, streaming at DCAUreview.com and on your favorite podcast app.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Welcome, everybody, to another bonus episode of the DCAU Review. I am Cal, one of your hosts. Joining me in just a moment will be my good friend, good brother, the man that runs our social media accounts, Liam. Today we have an opportunity to sit down with an incredible writer and someone that has just a laundry list of who's who's in the industry of animation. Writing credits that go decades back, and maybe most importantly to our listeners here on the podcast, was responsible for a lot of episodes of Static Shock, and we get into talking a little bit about that today. Mr. Len Yulee will be joining us, and Len also worked on an episode of Justice League as well, a pretty memorable one. We get into talking a little bit about that as well. We talk about his career, how he got started in the television business, how that moved from live-action sitcoms into his work on animation. And then from there, we kind of branch off and talk about all things his career. We talk a little bit about his work on X-Men, the animated series. We talk about some other smaller projects that he did on animation in the 80s. And then ultimately, how he ended up working on the Static Shock show. Talks a little bit about what it was like working with the late, great Dwayne McDuffie, shares some really wonderful stories about that, and a lot of other fun along the way. It is a hoot of a conversation, super entertaining. Len is just a wonderful human being and has a lot of knowledge and fun stories to share, so we are excited to finally release this interview in its entirety. We did preview a little bit of it on one of our episodes in August, and this will be an opportunity to hear everything that he had for our listeners. So without further ado, we'll throw it to ourselves in the past, speaking with Mr. Len Yulee.
All right. And as mentioned, we are very lucky to be joined today by a legendary writer in animation, that being the great Mr. Len Yulee. Len, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for inviting me, guys. I really appreciate it. And as I said before we started, I think you've probably interviewed everybody I've ever worked with. Some of this may sound familiar if we cross the streams a little. So apologize for the redundancy straight
just,
off.
You're just corroborating each other's stories, you know?
That's right. Yeah, it's our story, and we're sticking with it.
That's right. So before we launch into some more sort of DCAU themed topics, we'd like to just start by asking sort of what were your origin story, so to speak, getting into as a writer and specifically as a writer in animation.
Oh, well, okay. It's I hope you have an extra hour. Basically, I became an animation writer quite by accident. Mm. I started out as a wannabe sitcom writer. I had my first sale on a sitcom when I was 21. I was a junior at UCLA in the film school. And I saw a show got picked up, and it was called Holmes and Yo-Yo. Nobody remembers it, but it was 13 episodes on ABC. Two cops, one of whom was a robot. So, you know, clearly right up my alley straight away. But it was by the guys who had done Get Smart. So these were like comedy gods for me. Mm-hmm. So I read the show got picked up by, this would never happen today, but I got a chance to, I called the office, the production office. And I said, can I read a copy of the pilot script? And the woman there, the director of development, says, sure. Like, this would never happen. armies of lawyers who would make that not happen.
Right, say.
So I got a copy of the script. I read it. I said, oh, boy. And I wrote a story, not even a script, mind you. And I'd been writing, you know, spec scripts and all that sort of thing. So then I sat on it. Now, I have to say, at this point, I am a commuter. I am living at home. I am taking the bus to UCLA every day. And what are they going to do? They're not going to hire a guy in college with no credit.
Sure.
So I sat on the story. And my mom said, okay, I tell you what, I'll mail it for you. Okay, Mom. that's going to happen. 2 days later, the story editor calls me on a Friday and says, I'm going to make your weekend. So I said, really? And so what he did was they took he and his producer partner, they rammed my story together with some other material they already owned from a guy named John Landis. Not sure whatever happened to him, but anyway, you know, quite frankly, it was probably in pre-production on Animal House, so I don't think he missed the assignment too terribly. But anyway, so I got a chance to write the script, and you know, I was cocky. I was 21. I thought I knew what I was doing, and I didn't do a great job. Let's put it that way. But you know, it was a first assignment, and that was great. Following year, I had a TV series format optioned by a production company. It was about the first Black president of the United States. Like that could ever happen.
Right.
But well, it was 1977. You know, it's ancient history. So
right.
2 years, two assignments, graduating college. This is going to be easy. What a great career. Piece of cake. Rocket to the moon. 3 years of radio silence followed. Nothing happened.
Wow.
So if you want to say I was an overnight success, that's true if your definition of overnight is 10 years.
Wow.
So bumped around a few assignments hither and yon, lots of, you know, jobs in the meantime, office jobs, working at a lawyer's office, working as a producer's assistant on Benson, the sitcom.
Oh, yes.
Writing industrials and corporate shows. And that's where I learned how to be a professional writer, because you're writing for very little money. You're writing for make the client happy, writing, you know, taking notes on. So that's how I really learned, because whatever modicum of talent I might have had, I didn't have the skill set, the professionalism that, you know, at the beginning. So that was the series of lucky first breaks. Anyway, sorry, rambling on. Eventually, one of the mom and pop companies I worked for in the industrial and corporate thing, the pop was Michael Rye, a voice actor from radio, who was the voice of Duke Igthorne on The Gummy Bears.
Oh,
okay.
So a great comic villain. And so he introduced me to the story editor, Jim Magon. And Jim hired me to write a freelance Gummy Bears episode, and then hired me to write a freelance DuckTales episode, which, by the way, was called Where No Duck Has Gone Before. You'll see another thread running through that's a Star Trek fanboy thing here. Anyway, so, and then Disney TV Animation was ramping up because they were doing the DuckTales series, and then that was going to be followed by the Disney Afternoon, all those syndicated 65-episode, a two-hour block of television 5 days a week. Again, unheard of today. But by then, it was like, wow. So they were hiring people left and right, and so I got a chance to go on staff there. And just to put a button on the origin story, 2 weeks after I signed my contract at Disney, I heard from two story editors I had met on the picket line in 1985 for the Writers Guild, and they asked about my availability for the CBS version of Charles in Charge. Yes, I never got a chance to work for Scott Baio, because I had already signed this contract of being the Boy Scout. I was like, oh, no, I couldn't possibly. And that was the fork in the road, and that's when I became an animation writer. And so 47 years in the Writers Guild, 37 years in writing animation. And, you know, on balance, I guess it worked out. You know, I got a chance to write, you know, 260 some episodes of television.
Right.
And eventually I'll get it right. You know, in the meantime, I got a chance to work with some wonderful people on a lot of great shows, including some of the shows we're going to talk about today. So and that's my long-winded version of, so how did you get here? I'm still trying to figure it out. Sorry.
That's incredible. Wow. What a, what, that's like so many who's who's of people that are in Hollywood that you either cross paths with, worked with.
I am the Zelig of animation. I have worked with show business generally. I've worked with, or just alongside, just a glancing blow with ideal people. And, you know, I'm just sitting here being, you know, the working slob shoveling through into the next assignment. But yeah, it's been, it's been weird. I could go into stories, you know, had I grown up in, say, Detroit,
mm-hmm.
I would have gone to work for the Ford Motor Company, right? Yep. Company town. I grew up here in Los Angeles, and even weirder than that, on the wrong side of the tracks in Beverly Hills. You know, after the parents' divorce, we struggled to stay there, but Mom wanted to have us in good schools anyway. Yeah. So I grew up with all of these showbiz kids, you know, the sons and daughters of TV stars and studio heads and things like that. So company town, no other skills. Of course I'm going to want to be a writer.
Of course, yeah.
You know, the first episode, the first script I wrote was in sixth grade. It was a Star Trek script. I already had the pointy ears, so you know, I could do that. So I've been doing the, I wrote plays, musicals in high school and student films, and like probably most of the people you've talked with, it seemed like the thing that what other choice did I have?
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Anyway, so there you go. That's my sad tale.
No, whenever the book comes out, we'll be the first one to buy it, because that sounds
it'll be a coloring book, but
all right. Well, jumping off of that, let's fast forward the reason why we're having you on the show here, just even though that's an incredibly fascinating story. Spoiler alert, we're a DC Animated Universe podcast. So we're here
about your
work about the DC Animated Universe. And of course, the majority of which came from your work on Static Shock. So can you tell us a little bit about how did you get, you know, started on that project? Fast forward a little bit from where we left off in your origin story to getting assigned to that, and then the work that you did specifically. We're going to talk a little bit about the shebang episodes today, but yeah, how did you get involved with Static Shock, and in your experience, especially for what that show was at the time, I think culturally what it means even today.
Yes.
What's it like having worked on that episode or that show, and how did you get there?
Well, have to roll back to when I was at Disney for 5.5 years. One of the people I worked with there was Alan Burnett.
Never heard of him.
let me explain. Alan is as you well know, he's the undersung hero of the DC Animated Universe.
Nice. He's
a tremendously nice fellow and an extraordinarily good writer and a terrific showrunner. But anyway, Alan and I were working on things like Gummy Bears and Tailspin and shows like that together. And then he went back briefly. I think he went back to Hanna-Barbera, but then landed at Warner Brothers. Mm-hmm. And so he was running the Batman. I never got a chance to write on the Batman animated series, but of course thought it was brilliant.
Yeah.
But anyway, so eventually when I was no longer at Disney and had done some superhero stuff for Eric Lewald, also with whom I'd worked at Disney, but then became the showrunner on X-Men, the animated series. So, and of course I'd read comic books, mostly DC comic books, in fact, when I was a kid. So I knew the lingo there too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So anyway, I ended up, you know, Alan was then running, in addition to everything else in the Batman series and Superman, and all, he was also in charge of the, Static Shock after it had been developed, and he'd been playing a key role in that. Anyway, so he was kind enough to hire me to work on that. And so I ended up writing, you know, 16 of those on Static Shock. And so I was there as a freelancer, as a story editor, as a freelancer, you know, sort of the arc of the thing, but got a chance to work in all four seasons. And as you well know, it is a spectacular series. It holds up extremely well.
Yep.
And part of that is, of course, the origins of it, because, you know, people like the late Dwayne McDuffie and Dennis Cowan and all of their cohorts had created this wonderful universe, the Dakotaverse, for Milestone Comics, which was, the, as you know, the first African-American owned comic book company, and they did amazing things there. And Static was, developed as an animated series, you know, brought a little younger and things like that. But I had an affinity for it. I, you know, got a chance to write quippy dialogue, which is kind of my thing. And, so Alan was kind enough to bring me in and let me do all sorts of wonderful stuff. And that's also where I met Dwayne McDuffie, for whom I eventually also worked on a couple of iterations of the Ben 10 series over at Cartoon Network.
Nice.
And we can go on for another hour about what an extraordinary genius, honest to God genius, Dwayne McDuffie was.
Yeah.
I digress. Working on Static Shock was a wonderful experience with some very talented people. And because, again, of the showrunner in charge, in this case, Alan, later on the Ben 10 series with Dwayne and Glenn Murakami, you got a chance to work on a show that was, yes, a kids' action adventure show and great fun, and everybody after the treasure and things blow up and we get to say, but also we got a chance to do stuff that was about, I'm sorry if this sounds ostentatious, but the human condition, about stuff that matters, that comes from the heart. And so, you know, Dwayne and Alan, they wrote a show that got a Humanitas Award about gun violence, about bringing a gun to school. Mm-hmm. I got to write an episode called Frozen Out that was about
that episode.
Mental illness and the homeless. Yep. Now, this doesn't sound like kiddie fare, does it?
Not at all.
When you have people who are willing to go to bat and say, okay, yeah, we're not going to do another villain of the week. Yeah, we can do those, and did them very, very well indeed.
Oh, yes.
But we got a chance to write things that mattered to us and within the confines of, you know, Long Underwear Show. Mm-hmm. And so we're just, you know, that, again, one of those things that was so lucky for me that I got a chance to work with such brilliant people, all at the top of their game, you know? And so there were a lot of shows that I worked on where that has been the case. Static is one of them. I consider the Static and the Ben 10 runs for me, again, mostly freelancing, particularly on the Ben 10, but I got a chance to work on stuff that mattered, that I can look at with pride, and were very well made. So, I came out ahead in that regard.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, that's one of the things that we talked about. I mean, even going back to that, was what made Batman the Animated Series, why it's still impactful today, is because you can look back at those cartoons and compare them to other cartoons that were being developed at the time. And that sort of set the precedent that was then carried on. And especially but even more so with Static, when you have it coming from a position of writers that have experiences that a lot of other people haven't had, and their goal is to get those messages out there. For instance, you know, talking about racism or mental illness or, you know, classism or some of the other things how many cartoons covered that stuff on a weekly basis for a cartoon that was aimed at like Saturday morning kids, you know, from 8 to 15, like you didn't have that. So it is one of the reasons why we believe that Static is such an important and often overlooked cartoon, is because this is stuff that wasn't talked about or wasn't being talked about at that time. And now culturally has been brought more to the forefront, and you can see like, man, these guys were trying to talk about this stuff and kind of shine the spotlight on this stuff 20 years before it was in the more mainstream eye. So yeah, what an incredible legacy for that show.
You know, that the thing is, there are a few shows that I've worked on that gave us the chance to do things like that. I mentioned X-Men, the animated series. Mm-hmm. You know, Eric Liewold ran a spectacular show that was not written as a kiddie show. It was really good drama or melodrama or whatever you want to call it, but we were able to tell stories. I mean, the whole basis of it is about prejudice, right? Mm-hmm. It's about the other. And, and we got a chance to talk about incredibly important issues that were important to us, all of us.
Yeah.
We got a chance to read that show. And the same thing with you know, as Static, you know, we were just, it was a wonderful wide palette. We could paint in all the corners, and we could do big silly, and we could do Night of the Living Brain Puppets or whatever I called it, Attack of the Living Brain Puppets. I had to look up my own credits. You know, not a Humanitas winner, but so much fun to write. You know, ooh. And we got to do we were doing Body Snatchers, and we were doing a Reese Witherspoon movie. Right. We slapped those together. You know, it's absolutely. Like okay, why not? It's a cartoon. Do weird things, and then that was so great about working on shows like that. And you brought up the three things with Shebang. You know, full disclosure: the first episode of Shebang was a story of Alan Burnett. So he created the character, and he handed this teleplay to me, and so I got a chance to write that character and develop that character, and sort of find out who she was, in addition to the great foundation he had provided me. And I'm sure you've heard this from many of your other interviewees. When you're working in a freelance or a staff situation, you're in the service of the series, and the series is supervised by the showrunner, by the supervising producer, whatever the terminology they use. And those are the people you want to please them, then they'll hire you again. But you also, you know, you can't go off and do a musical if you're doing a dark drama. You have to sort of fit within the guardrails and then find your own way of expressing yourself within those parameters. Right. So, in this case, Alan wrote a great story, and we had, terrific producers and directors. It was interesting. I went back and watched the three episodes. First of all, I had forgotten the one in the middle. I had forgotten the Parent Trap.
It was funny. We had that same discussion amongst ourselves. We're like, I thought, because it's Shebang and Shebak. I was like, okay, it's just those two, right? And then I was looking. Yeah.
Well,
thank God for Google.
but it's actually, I enjoyed it. I mean, first of all, we had a really good villain, Ron Perlman, who's a fabulous actor, played the bad guy in that. Absolutely. And it was like, watching it so many years later, it was like a surprise to me as audience. It was like, oh wait, what are the parents doing? After all these episodes, I've forgotten some of them, but it was a good experience. I enjoyed watching it again, and again, all of the performers, oh my gosh, Andrea Romano, the voice director.
Yes.
She would cast people you would never think would even do a cartoon, but she had this phrase, come and play with us. And then she'd get all these incredible people to do a cartoon episode. And so that was the case. And I got a chance to work with her on several series at various studios. Excuse me. And wow, what a pleasure, because she, just to focus on one person, she was the one that sort of, she could find subtext in what you'd written that you didn't know about. I mean, it would be helpful if I could remember the episodes altogether. But, but she was just wonderful in bringing stuff out and bringing performances from people that it was just brilliant nuances and funny stuff. I mean, a lot of these people are just so hilarious. There's nothing for a cartoon writer. There's nothing, no greater thrill than being able to go to a recording session and hear these people who are funny and brilliant and quirky and just so wonderful, bringing your words to life and making them so much better. And, I got lucky right off the bat when I was at Disney working with people who were the voices of my childhood, like June Foray, Rocking Bullwinkle, and Paul Winchell and people like that. And Corey Burton, who was one of the younger guys back then.
One of our favorites.
All of them so versatile and terrific. And, later on working with people like Maurice LaMarche and Rob Paulsen, who are just, they walk into a room and you start laughing immediately.
Right.
And then you see, they bring in like somebody like Andrea would bring in, somebody like all these big TV and movie stars. And you say, oh, wait a minute, I'm going to fanboy now.
Right. So,
it's just like, where else would I meet Mark Hamill?
Right.
Except in a recording session of Static Shock. I did the first.
Yes, the Big Leagues.
Of the superhero crossover. So it was the Big Leagues, that Joker showing up in Decoder. And that was wild, you know. Okay, look, there's Batman. Oh, look, there's Luke Skywalker. Right. You know, what happened here? But that was. And by the way, all lovely people, self-effacing, funny, charming. You know, it's just again, pretty good way to earn a living. You know, to get yeah. this. You know, you put the words down, and somebody says them, and they're funny, and they're, right. you know. Okay, thank you. I'll take that.
Right. There you go.
I was going to say, I think for us personally, I think the big leagues were, we probably slept on the first season of Static. And then that, when the big leagues, we saw Batman and Robin were coming to the town. That's kind of when we jumped on board the series when we were kids and kind of kept watching all the way through after that. So that was a very seminal episode for us, for sure.
Glad to be the gateway drug here, because, you know, Static. Static was a wonderful experience, you know, again, top-notch people. And I think it should have gone longer, but of course, as I'm sure you've been told, oh, they couldn't get a toy deal, you know, because you know what the rationale would be. Oh, right. We couldn't possibly sell toys with Black Lee. But
right.
God, I don't know. Talk to the people who've done Black Panther. I think they were wrong back then.
Yeah, you know? They were wrong back then. Yeah.
Absolutely. And you know, eventually, I think there were a few toys after maybe Justice League Unlimited or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it's like, yeah, come on. It was a great character. And I loved writing him and Richie and all the others. It's just, it was a picnic, because you get yeah. to just do all these funny character asides, and then you get to do big action. Mm-hmm. And yeah, you know, and no complaints.
What more could you ask for when writing a superhero show, right?
Well, residuals, but don't get on the disparities there.
Place to start.
Yeah.
Yeah, you walked into that one. Sorry, guys.
That's good.
I would just say, as a follow up to kind of your you know, the pride you have in Static Shock, I believe I read you wrote or you're credited as writing 16 episodes of that series, if I'm not.
Yeah.
Not mistaken, yeah. And then also credited as a story editor on some others. So can you just kind of, for this, maybe get a little bit inside baseball on what is a story editor? What is their job on a show?
Well, that's, you know, it depends on the show. When I was a story editor working, Chris Simmons and I were story editors working for Alan Burnett on Static. And so basically we edited. He would say, okay, this great script needs to be rewritten, or would you take this story and turn that into a teleplay and stuff like that, when, you know, we're trying to crank through all of these episodes as quickly as possible. Sometimes, and so basically we're kind of being staff writers and staff rewriters and things like that. However, in animation, because the sort of job titles are much more limited than in live action. You know, you can see all the other credits that people have on a situation, right. For example. But here, sometimes a story editor can be the showrunner. That's the title they've been given, depending on the studio, you know, or head writer or things like that. So for me, I was not a showrunner. That was Alan's job. But I was able to sort of be, you know, useful. That's, I mean, for anybody who's writing a freelance episode or writing a, you know, on staff, you're feeding the machine. You're trying to be helpful to the guy who's your boss or gal who's your boss, because at the end of the day, especially if you're a freelancer, to turn in a script that makes your story editor have to spend his or her weekend rewriting you, that's not a friendly thing to do. You're not right. you're not gonna be asked back. You right. know, a story editor I used to work for named Stan Berkowitz, he said, I want to find the people who will make my life easier. And right. so that's exactly right. Your job as a writer is to be useful, to be the utility infielder, to be the guy or gal who can say, okay, you want a happy funny, you want a sad sorry, whatever it is, I'll do those things for you. And then you can do your magic, and then we record the show, and a year later you get an episode, you know.
Very insightful. I love that.
Yeah, I don't want to get too much in the weeds, but you know,
that's what we do here.
I said that's one of the things that's one of the things we're always excited when we get someone who, you know, who worked on these shows, especially in different facets of it, whether it's writing, directing, storyboarding, whatever. We love
majority of my career has been as a freelancer. Yes, I was on staff at Disney for 5.5 years. I was on staff in one form or another at Warner's for a year, year and a half, things like that. A couple of other things, but most of the time it's just been, putting me in, coach. You know, you've got work, you've got a show. How many of these can I do for you?
Right,
you know, that kind of thing. Because, as you also know, as I hinted at with the lack of residuals, writing in animation is not as well compensated as writing in live action.
Right.
So you have to be a volume business. You have to write as many as you can. You know, if you've got a rhythm going and you've got a couple of people who are willing to hire you, you kind of got to checkerboard it to make your nut, you know, to pay your mortgage, to whatever, to put your kid through school. These are things that are different in live action, where and we're on strike right now at the Writers
Guild. Yes, absolutely.
But they're on strike because the studios would love to have, especially now in the streaming model, they would like to impose the business model that I have worked under my entire animation career: small or non-existent writing rooms, suppressed wages, no residuals. And they'd like to impose that on all the shows that you watch, that you love, on the streamers and the networks. You know, network television, it ain't what it used to be. You know, there were people who were making millions of dollars, who had great, they could afford two houses and three divorces, you know, that kind of thing. But today, there are people on award-winning shows, on the streamers particularly, you know, the 6-8 episode shows, and they have to take a second job because, you know, like a real world job, because they get to write for 6 or 8 episodes on a series. They're on staff for, you know, a much truncated period of time. And then there's no work for a year. You don't go from show to show to show.
Wow.
And it's not right. It's making it impossible to be a writer in the current business environment. So that's why the Writers Guild is on strike. And I have now immediately dated this recording for you. So a year from now, when people watch this, they'll say, "What strike?"
Well, so, I was going to say,
sorry about that.
The strike might be over by the time our listeners hear this, but I'm going to guess the issues you raised will not be settled.
They are significant. They are industry changing. But I won't continue on my soapbox. We can talk about all the politics in the cartoons.
That's right.
Hey, they go hand in hand if you watch closely, especially with the DCAU. There's a lot of commentary.
I would say, it's funny you mentioned X-Men. It's like, oh yeah, we hate comics that are political in nature. We hate superhero stories that have that talk about, you know, racism or sexism or bigotry. You know,
you never read the comic books?
Right, exactly.
What is wrong with you people?
There was about a month ago, I think, or maybe 2 months ago, on Twitter that people were talking about this and complaining. And regardless of where you are politically on the spectrum, all I had to do is go back to the 1940s and pull up all these examples of comic books of them promoting buying war bonds, doing this. Like, it has been whatever political happenings have been happening or societal happenings have been happening, comic books have always been a part of that conversation. It is not limited to 2023.
Right. And if you think of all the people who created the superheroes that we all know and love, I mean, it's the immigrant experience.
Yes.
Let's punch Nazis.
Yes.
You know? And that's where all these guys came from. The Kirby's and Simons and the Siegels and Schuster's and all those people came from the mindset that we're lucky to be here. We love our country. And by the way, let's punch some Nazis.
Right.
And, it's just, and truth, justice, and the American way really was real and heartfelt. Yeah. It was not cynical.
Absolutely.
You know, so that's the origin of the guys in the long underwear and the cape. That's what this is all about. We're fighting injustice.
Absolutely.
We're fighting for a better world.
Absolutely.
I mean, on X-Men, I'm sorry, this is not on topic for you guys.
That's
but,
okay.
You know, the first episode I wrote was the introduction of Iceman.
Mm-hmm.
Really, what it was a story about a dysfunctional surrogate father-son relationship.
Mm-hmm.
The next two episodes I wrote were using the character Nightcrawler, whom you see over my shoulder. And that's the first time in mainstream animation that issues of faith were discussed, particularly in the first episode.
Yeah.
And then the other episode, Bloodlines, was about the dysfunctional relationship between Kurt Wagner, Nightcrawler, and his mom, who's Mystique and not Parent of the Year. Okay. And so, you know, it's just like, again, I got lucky. I worked for people who said, yeah, go with this, run with this, do something that speaks to you, because that's the dirty little secret. We all are writing for ourselves.
Yeah.
We're writing it's a weird mentality. You know, writers have profoundly low self-esteem, and yet we think we have something that everybody has to hear about. You guys should know what I think about X, Y, and Z. You know, I mean, it's just... What a strange way to earn a living. Okay. And yet here we are talking to
people. Where would we be without it? You know?
Yeah. 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 Well, we'd be reading more books, but anyway. where would the fun
be in that?
I don't know.
You mentioned working with the late, great Dwayne McDuffie. So a criminally underrated, and I don't think he's gotten his flowers, so to speak, even today, even as people are beginning to discover just what the impact he had on not only the comic book industry, mm-hmm. but certainly the cartoon industry. His writing in the third in the seasons of Justice League Unlimited that we've covered some of the episodes and obviously watched when we were growing up, just to this day, thinking about, again, this idea of these episodes being written during the Bush administration and talking about, like, you know, government oversight and where the government's, you know, where the government's line is drawn versus, you know, the betterment of the world versus the country. There's so many deep things.
Interventionism and you know, who holds the most powerful accountable and things like that.
Just incredible topics. Again, we're talking about things that you wouldn't necessarily expect to be covered in a Saturday morning cartoon. But do you have any anecdotes, anything that you remember specifically working with him, whether it be on Static or Ben 10, that you can just say, point to and go, like, man, this is a great story for example of what an incredible human this guy was?
Well, all right, you see, this is the part where I start crying. So that's going to be really nice. I did not. Dwayne was early on Static Shock. Dwayne was he wasn't involved with Static that much. He wrote episodes, but he was not involved in the running of the show. Mm-hmm. But in fact, he may have even, but when I just started, I think he had just moved from or was going to move from Florida and came here. And right out of the gate, this guy moved up so quickly because of the extraordinary intelligence and talent that he had. Mm-hmm. You know, people use the word genius in a cavalier manner in the entertainment industry. Oh, he's a genius because he wrote this show or whatever. Dwayne was an actual genius. I mean, he went to college when he was 14 or something. Then he went back to high school to have a normal child. And then he went back to college and got 2 degrees. He would read a book a night. He would write a script faster than anybody, and it was better than anybody else could do. I learned a whole lot about writing when I worked for him on Ben 10. And he had seen what I had done on Static Shock and liked what I had done for his character, basically.
Yeah.
And so when he went over to reboot Ben 10 and make it a little older and things like that, that's when he said, you could come and write for me. And I said, oh, please. But no, I mean, I got to know him. We were not buddies, but I was thrilled to work for him because he was so damn smart. Oh my God. And you know, it was a little intimidating. I mean, just he was about 6'19". He was
deep. Right,
and it's intimidating. And yet is incredibly droll and bright, so smart and so well read, and you know, it makes me feel like I'm such a dummy just being in the room with this guy. And so, you know, outside of the am I really supposed to be here he was just so wonderful. And got again off topic for you guys, but on Ben 10 we got to write a bunch of stuff that was, you know, very funny. I did one called Con of Wrath. It was just a romp. But there were really dark ones too, really sort of interesting psychological studies, and just I don't know, I think I've met a few people whose talent is just so blindingly bright. He's at the top of that list. I mean, I've worked with some really great writers, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
But there was just something astonishing about him, and the fact that he did so much in such a short period of time. That's perhaps the greatest tragedy of his premature demise, because he had so much more to give.
Yeah.
And meeting him, working with him, knowing him was a privilege.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, sorry.
That's good. No, that's wonderful.
It's just go back and just watch some of the runs on Alien Force and Ultimate Alien, the shows I worked for. I also worked on Omniverse, which was the last of the three series, and that was run by his widow, Charlotte, and his best friend from high school and college, Matt Wayne. And you know, continuing the legacy, he had developed the show and then passed away. And so but the stuff that I worked on for him, like I say, all of 24 episodes for the whole run for me, but I think I did 18 or whatever for him. It just, what an experience. Oh my God. It just, anyway, I'm just,
now I'm
just going off into reverie. So you don't expect me to be coherent for a couple of minutes. I apologize.
That's quite right. We threw you a curveball. So thank you for being vulnerable and sharing that stuff with us.
No, it was just what a remarkable individual, and everybody who worked with him was enriched by the experience of doing so. And some became great friends of his. Eugene's son, I think he was one of the people who introduced Charlotte to Dwayne. And so, there are a lot of really just wonderful, great writers, but lovely people who were part of that whole period in life. So, anyway, sorry.
I think if anything about Mr. McDuffie's legacy is that I don't think that I've ever read or heard somebody in an interview say any cross thing about him. If anything, it's always been what an incredible human being first, and then talk about who he was, just what a brilliant person he was. So it's not surprising to hear that he was just, you know, from your perspective.
He also had the courage of his convictions, and he did not suffer fools gladly. And if there was some executive who, you know, was going to give notes that were not based in anything except personal opinion, I don't think he much cared for getting those notes, because the thing about him was he was always right. he could tell a story better than anybody. So, and again, this is the thing with people like Alan and people like Dwayne, if you hit a roadblock, in about 10 seconds, they would say, oh no, here's what you do. And it would always be right. Wow. Alan could walk into, you know, people running around with their hair on fire, in a meeting or a production meeting or something like that. And he'd say, here's the solution. And he'd tell them, and everybody would calm down. This sort of Zen master would do. And with Dwayne, it was just like, okay, I'm going to listen to you now. And it would all be resolved, and then you'd go home and you'd do it, and you'd say, "Oh gosh, that is a good idea." the stumble bums like me, you know, who are just, you know, glad to be there. That makes our job easier, because you just say, "Okay, I know what to do because I listened to this guy."
Right.
Anyway,
you're like, it's like performing the trapeze act, but you have a net there to catch you.
That's good.
An extraordinarily talented net.
Yes.
Boy, that's a weird analogy.
Maybe that doesn't hold up exactly, but
no, whatever. We know where we're going for there. It's just there we'll workshop that one. Yeah.
Absolutely. Get back to us. But kind of wrapping up, we've already, I think, touched on a few, but outside of, say, Static, you've mentioned Ben 10, you mentioned X-Men, some of your work at Disney. What are kind of the projects that you've worked on over the years that you see as the ones you're most proud of?
Well, you know, starting out on things like DuckTales and Tailspin and Darkwing, things like that, that's a pretty good way to get your feet wet.
Absolutely.
You know? And Winnie the Pooh and all the other things. X-Men the Animated Series was great, because when I was done at Disney, when I didn't renew my contract, Eric Leewald had already gone over and he was running this show. And so I had a soft landing in the superhero business and got a chance to sort of work between the funny animals and the people in long underwear and all that kind of stuff. I also got a chance to write some home video features. One, a couple of them, The American Tale 3 and 4. And Land Before Time 7, only one Land Before Time. But so I got to work with, you know, Jewish mice and talking dinosaurs. So that was fun. Recently, I've worked for a guy named Rob Hoagie, who's a fantastic showrunner. Mm-hmm. And he's done shows like Stillwater, which is on Apple Plus. Beautiful, gorgeous preschool show. Just spectacular and so different than anything else we do, because it's all about mindfulness and it dials down the kids instead of jamming them up, you know.
Right.
He also, a few years ago, he did a redo of Thunderbirds Are Go, which was a puppet show back in the 60s from the Brits, but it was redone with Peter Jackson's company did the special effects, and it was practical effects and CG characters, and it is absolutely beautiful also, and fun. So, you know, I've even just one-offs. I did Rescue Bots for Nicole Dubuque and Brian Holfeld. And I got a chance to do use Maurice LaMarche to do a War of the Worlds spoof.
Yes.
Again, you know, awesome. Sometimes when you get to meet your heroes. I have a number of shows I've worked on there, and it's like, did I do that? Oh, yeah, I did six of those. you know, nobody's going to look for my tombstone and find Dork Hunters from Outer Space. it's there somewhere, you know. I was very glad to have the work, by the way. Any employment, because, yeah, like I say, it's a volume business and you're scrambling all the time to get the next gig. So, you know, glad to have all of the jobs, you know.
Absolutely.
You know, and you get a chance to write. I did one for Matt Wynn called on a show called Cannon Busters.
Mm-hmm.
And that was like violent and sexy and weird. And, you know, not using those muscles when I'm doing Hello Kitty, but, you know, that's the lesson. You've got to be able to be versatile enough that you can say, oh, that's what's selling now. I can learn to do that, or I can do this kind of show too. Because, you know, that's the thing. Tastes change, and the kind of shows that are being made now are very different than the kind of shows that were being made when I started out in the Stone Age. So, you know, and that's another show I worked on too called Stone Age. But
good.
It's hard to keep track.
Boom.
Anyway, so you know, what can I say? I've been very fortunate. Mm-hmm. I've worked with so many talented people. They've been kind enough or silly enough to hire me. So it's been a good run. I'm not done yet. I'm not dead yet, as they
That's
say.
Right.
But I've had a nice time of it for the most part, and I'm very, very fortunate. I'm very grateful.
I was going to say it's fun that you shouted out some kind of those one shots you did, because something I think we found, because we mainly do these main Alan Burnett, Bruce Timm shows, but sometimes we venture into other DC animated stuff or even a weird little one offs once in a while just to shake things up. And what we find, every show is somebody's favorite show.
Mm-hmm.
Every time we do a new, you know, whether it's Young Justice or we did an episode of the Spider-Man animated series for an April Fool's episode last year.
Right.
And as soon as we announced, you know, we put on our Twitter that we were doing that, we just immediately got a bunch of responses like, oh my God, this was my show. This meant so much to me, you know? And that's, you know, so you always think about that when you look at someone like yourself who has such a, you know, versatile body of work to your name. It's like, yeah, every one of those shows meant a lot to somebody.
Well, yeah. And Greg Weissman between Gargoyles and the Young Justice and the Teen Titans, you know, all those very, very powerful, impactful shows that people adore, that there's fan followings. That's the thing that we, you know, people like myself, we go to these conventions, not as much now, but we do. And we hear the common phrase is, you made my childhood. Well, to us, it's like, well, that was my day job. but then we hear how much these shows mean. And that really, it takes our breath away. It's humbling, because all of a sudden we understand that it wasn't just you know, aren't we clever? We have no other skills. We're going to be writers. but we get this wonderful feedback from people. Talking with guys like you, it's like, how lucky are we that we get to do this thing that people remember fondly, and they're introducing their children to it, and it's like, mm-hmm. wow. So that's like, okay, that's a perk we had not anticipated.
Yeah,
there it is. You know,
you have a legacy. Like,
yeah, I guess. Yeah, I mean, like I say, residuals would be nice too.
Right, but that would be much better.
Yeah, a legacy and an annuity, but you know.
You can't, don't get can't me cash started. In. Can't cash in. Good yeah. thoughts in
no, there. But the affection is it's a different kind of remuneration. It really is kind of wonderful because, I mean, we hear how much people loved it and how it was part of their childhood, and it was in some cases how it got them through their childhood.
Yeah.
Whoa. Absolutely. I mean, gosh, we were just doing jokes, man. You right. know? And yet here we are. And thank you is basically yeah. it. It's just yeah. anyway, it's a lot of fun, and it's also quite moving.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely.
Yeah.
So I think now if we could just kind of touch on the Shebang episodes with a little bit more.
Oh, of course. Of course. Yeah. Like I say, the first one.
Mm-hmm.
Based on a story from Alan, and that was great, and got a chance to establish the tension between mm-hmm. Shanice and Virgil. Mm-hmm. And the second one, I think the tension ramped up a little. He got kind of pissed at her
uh-huh.
in the midst yeah. of that because she was sort of being cocky, and that was covering up her fear.
Yes.
And then we did She Back. And that brought in the other great character I got to work on that I created with Alan's guidance was Madeline Spaulding.
That's right.
Who was our election, our Reese Witherspoon character and with superpowers because what were we doing? But, you know, that was a lot of fun because we got to see, you know, two very strong female characters, one psychotic, and again, what an opportunity to write such fun characters, work with great actors, mm-hmm. you know, how can I go wrong? It was so much fun to work on those shows. And again, thank you for reminding me. Yes. I've written one of them, but I guess I should drink more coffee. I should learn to drink coffee. I don't drink coffee. I'm going to find out how. It's been dandy. I will again digress back to one of the shows you mentioned, which is Justice League. I did get a chance to write that sort of. I wrote one and a half parts of Metamorphosis, and you know, with Tom Sizemore, who's gone now. In that role, mm-hmm. but what was so fun about that was right because I'd read the Metamorpho comics mm-hmm. growing up, mm-hmm. and so you know the people involved. It was directed. I think those were directed by Dan Reba, who's a terrific director.
Uh-huh.
They really did great on the models because that really looked like the comic books.
Yes,
and absolutely. So you know, and. The late Earl Bowen, I believe, was the voice of Simon Stagg. And yep. what a creepy, horrible person he was, who had an unusual affection for his daughter.
Yes.
Well, we covered that. I was going to say, it's, like, it's not sound even like, subtext. It's just text in that story.
Sound like any former presidents we know?
Oh.
Sorry, guys. I just lost half your audience.
You know, we talk about it. We call them retroactive Easter eggs when we see things that happened at a time period where things haven't actually happened yet. But then we look back at them now and we go, like, yeah, that is alluding to that.
Say, everybody gives The Simpsons credit for being.
Well, The Simpsons, of course, does that brilliantly.
But that's a lot in these shows we review, too, that.
Well, I mean, that's an army of really smart writers, too. But and they get residuals. I'm sorry. I keep coming back to this.
It's important. Oh,
this is not going to go over well with them. There goes the rest of my career.
Get out of here. Yeah. No, but those episodes, I mean, the 1.5 episodes that you're responsible for.
And the teleplay on the second part was written by Dwayne McDuffie. Because I guess there was a time crunch or something. I don't remember the details now, but it was like, okay, I'm working on mine and he has to pick up and do the other thing. And of course, you know, happy to have Dwayne write anything. You know? So, you know, that I benefited from his talent there on the tail end of my time on, my brief time on Justice, which was a brilliant show.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think it all comes back to what we've been talking about there, especially when you mentioned the superhero shows and being able to tell, you know, interesting character stories in the midst of the explosions and the tights and everything. You brought it up with the Shebang episodes. It's like that first one, it starts out as this kind of really fun, light, like anything you can do, I can do better, battle of the sexes feel to it. And you think that's going to be the episode, but then it becomes like a spy espionage with this secret government facility that's, you know, experimented on this poor girl. And she and her parents have been running for years and she finally feels like she's found a place where she can show her true self to the world. But, you know, they find her anyway, and her parents just trying to be the protectors, trying to be the, you know,
get a little fugitive action in there, like a fugitive story.
Yeah. And that kind of being the through line for all of her appearances, of her looking for that sense of belonging, both with Virgil and Richie as character, you know, as a superhero, but also, you know, going through to the second and third episodes where she's trying to fit in at the high school. It's like, it's a show aimed for all ages, but for, you know, for kids, it's like, yeah, going to a new school and you're like, everybody tells you just be yourself, and then you be yourself and people kind of pull back a little bit. Right. And then you go, well, what do I do now? And her dealing with that through a superhero lens, I think is really fun and really accessible to anybody, but especially I think to, you know, kids and teenagers who were in school at the time.
You nailed it on the head. Thank you very much. I mean, it really is. I mean, we were all kids once. We all had this experience and continue to this day. Absolutely. In a work environment, right? Instead of being in your elementary school class. We all have those feelings, and that we get to express them. What a privilege that is. What an opportunity. And that it resonates for others makes these shows successes, you know, to one degree or another. And I think Static was a success. It was really, I think, the highest rated show they had on, even in repeats.
Yeah.
It was really a...
For sure won an Emmy too, didn't it?
I've been nominated for 5 Emmys, never won an Emmy. We were nominated twice on Static. I'm not sure, maybe something on the art side got an Emmy, certainly well deserved, you know, and of course the Humanitas Award that Alan and Dwayne shared. Mm-hmm. It's a top-notch show. Mm-hmm. Glad to be part of it, and I do look fondly back on those times, you know.
Yeah, and maybe my last question is sort of that, as a writer, once you've turned the script in, turned it, are you able to be involved with, like, when the director and the storyboard artists are working on it? Are you involved at all? And are you speaking with them about how you kind of envisioned a certain scene going as well? Or do you leave that more to the masters to make their magic?
Well, both. Mm-hmm. If you're a freelancer, no, you don't get a chance to do it. You watch the show a year later,
right?
But for when you're on staff, as I was during a period part of this Static time, I got to interact with the directors and the storyboard artists.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an absolutely, that's the kind of collaboration that you dream about, because, you know, you could look at the board and you say, oh, that's brilliant, and you plus this, and oh, by the way, you've got, and you can also, because it's a collaborative thing, they can say, you know what I'd like to do instead, and I'd say, oh, well, that's great. Or I can say to them, guys, I think you've got a camera direction problem. You need to flip that, because this is going to happen there. And that's kind of give and take. But yeah, working in that situation, you get a chance to look at the character designs, and you get a chance to see how the boards are going. And yes, you get a chance to go to the recording sessions, which, as I say, oh boy, is that fun.
Mm-hmm. So cool.
You know, no, I'm not in there calling retakes. That's not the job of this staff writer in any way, of course, but I am privy to what's been going on. I mean, I remember back in the day at Disney, I'd written an episode that was a superhero spoof for DuckTales. And I was handed the storyboard and they said, congratulations, you're 5 minutes over. You've got to make the cuts. So I did. And that was an unusual situation because I've overwritten the masked mallard. I was meant to be doing the spandex shows.
Yes.
even in back in the DuckTale days, even in the early days. But so you sometimes you get those jobs. And so it's a teaching moment. And this is, you know, what we all want to have. We want to have people who are all on the same team working on to the same goal.
Right. And
when you're a freelancer, that's simply not possible. But for those who are fortunate enough to be working in a staff situation, there's nothing better. It's just great. It really is.
Len, thank you so much for taking all of this time with us. We can't believe that you donated over an hour worth of your time with us today. Thank you for being so generous with that.
Thank you for inviting me. It's a pleasure to talk to you both. And thank you also for supporting all of these shows that were so important to all of us who, you know, got a chance to work on them. That was what a nice thing that you remember them well and have opinions about them.
Yeah.
And want to share what you feel about what we've done.
Yeah, that's good. No, that's perfect. No, thank you for taking the time. And just as you said, since we are fans, thanks for all of the hard work that you put into making this show, the everything else that we haven't had the opportunity to appreciate, that, as we mentioned, is probably somebody else's favorite or they remember fondly out there. So thanks for all of your life's work. And we're excited to see what else you're doing. So feel free to let us know once the strike is over and hopefully conditions have improved. Please let us know if there's anything that we can share with the good people that you're working on that's coming out. We're happy to share that because we love supporting people that have worked in the DCAU.
It's the least we could do.
Yeah, it's the least we could do.
I do have a sitcom pilot that takes place in a struggling animation studio. Right, what you know.
I'll say, where's the inspiration for that come from?
Just completely out of whole cloth. Yeah. And whether or not that ever sees the light of day, who knows? But I'm told it's amusing. So,
there we go. Well, we'll cross our fingers and say some prayers.
Knock on wood, when it's coming back on, we'll hopefully we can have you back on and we can talk about it. And
that would be fun, wouldn't it? Okay. Absolutely. Thank you guys. Really, really appreciate it.
I up to you. Do you want to share your social media handles? And
I'm
plugs and all that.
I'm at Len Yulia on Twitter. I don't really have I stalk on Instagram. I don't really post on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And no, my FaceTime is for me and my family.
There you go.
I should say my Facebook. FaceTime, definitely me and my family.
Definitely for you and your family.
That's misspoke. Sorry. But yeah. No, mostly you'll see me posting on Twitter about, running into personal heroes and fellow picketers on the picket line. I'm usually picketing at Amazon or Sony or. And next week, there's a picket, an animation picket outside of the Walt Disney Studios.
Well, there you go.
Well, where else better to pick it?
I would say.
It made sense at the time. Yeah. Anyway, fighting the good fight, waiting for a fair deal, and thank you for your support.
Absolutely. I'll just say personally, our dad was in the Teamsters Union for a very long time.
Okay.
And he always said, unions aren't perfect, but they're the best shot you have at, getting any that the individual worker has at getting anything resembling a fair deal still.
Absolutely.
That gave us a good childhood. The fact that he had a job that was in the Teamsters Union was afforded us a lot more that a lot of people weren't able to. So,
OK, I'm going to give you a little tip.
Sure.
Look, Lindsay Doherty. She is local 399, the Teamsters out here in Los Angeles. She's the Teamsters who work on drive the trucks and other vehicles. out here in the entertainment industry. She's a force of nature. She is fantastic. She has a Jimmy Hoffa tattoo on her arm. She is amazing. Just watch the speeches. Not for kiddies. Her language is a little coarse. More than a little coarse. But she is hilarious. There was a Writers Guild meeting a few weeks ago at the Shrine Auditorium, and I rode up in the elevator with him from the parking structure, and it was like, ooh, she's intimidating just standing here. And she is articulate and persuasive. Check it out. Your Teamster blood will just bubble with excitement about her. she's great, and standing side by side with the writers, as are all of the other unions, the IATSE, including the Animation Guild, the people who covered the shows that we've discussed. Mm-hmm. They're standing with us. There's been periods of animosity between the two, but we're all united because the giant multinational corporations, they don't have our best interests at heart. Let me put it to you. Mm-hmm. We all have to stick together.
Absolutely. And,
you know, unions created the middle class.
In
Detroit and other places, unions, yes, not perfect, because you get three people in a room, you're going to have office politics. But unions are the only way that we can survive as workers in any business. I was at a picket last week that the janitors are organizing when their contract is expiring, because the people who own the buildings are treating them poorly.
Yeah.
The Teamsters just made a deal with the people who produce commercials. So it's worth the fight, because we're all back to chattel, and that's not a great place to be. So anyway, sorry to end on a note.
No, not at all. Well, thank you so much.
So much fun.
Yeah.
Really appreciate it. Thank you very much. And look forward to hearing it next month.
And a special thanks once again to Mr. Len Yulee for joining us on the podcast today. Man, what a wonderful opportunity to sit down with him and just hear his experience throughout the industry, his passion for the SAG-AFTRA strike that is currently occurring still. This interview was recorded a little over a month and a half ago, and we're still in the middle of that. So I love hearing his thoughts on that and his passion for why that strike matters to so many people in the industry. And we thank Mr. Len for his time, for his candidness, and his willing to share so many wonderful stories. We look forward to hopefully having him on again in the future, perhaps to talk about some additional static episodes. But it was awesome. If you didn't get the opportunity to listen to our Len Yulee Appreciation Month, check that out in the archives. We have 4 specific episodes, all penned by Mr. Yulee, all kind of intertwined and related, as you heard, talking specifically about the character She Bang. And so check those out in the archives at dcaureview.com or on your favorite podcast app. Thank you, everybody, for tuning in today. Don't forget, there's a couple ways that you can support the podcast. You can do so by following us on social media at dcaureview. You can also, if you listen to us on a podcast app and it allows you to leave a review, if you leave us a 5-star review, we would greatly appreciate that. You can also check out the show notes here, and there's a couple of links in the show notes on how to support us as well. You can donate to us if you'd like to and subscribe monthly with a monthly donation, or head over to our merchandise store and pick up a shirt or a hat or a mug of some kind to support the pod. And of course, you can also, if you don't follow us on a podcast app, perhaps you consume your podcasts on YouTube, head over to youtube.com/thepodtower, where you not only get our entire catalog, but you also get some great content from other DCAU creators like The Watchtower, Database, and Tim Talk. Don't forget, we will be continuing with our month of Justice League Unlimited reviews as we continue here in the month of September on our standard episodes. And Liam and I can't wait to cover those. We are right in the smack dab in the middle of the amazing Cadmus story arc written by the aforementioned Dwayne McDuffie. We can't wait to go through those with you. But until then, I'm Cal. and we'll talk to you on the next episode of the DCAU Review.